Genesis 18 is where I'd like to start with you this morning. Genesis 18, we're going to read 9 through 15 together. We're eventually going to work our way back to Ephesians 3 at the very end, but we're going to go to this Old Testament passage, and then we're going to go to a passage in Mark's Gospel, and then we'll end there in Ephesians. You know, you and I are people who have lots of limitations. We only have two arms and two legs. We can only be in one place at one time, much as I have wished to have no limitations with that and be able to have some clones with me and be able to be lots of different places doing lots of different things. I think many of us have probably wished that. But we only have so much of what we have. We only have so much money. We only have so much time. We only have so much energy. We only have so many resources, and then we're done. We only got that much. And everybody around us, the other people that we live with, that we see, that we work with, they all have the same kinds of limitations that we do. And so there's only so much that we can accomplish until we reach a certain point where things are just too hard for us. And so, maybe for all those reasons, it's sometimes difficult for us to truly believe in a God like the one that we serve, who has no limitations whatsoever, who is able to do, as Ephesians 3 talks about, so far beyond what we can ask or even think about in our minds to ask about when it comes to God and His plans. So much of the time, and I'm speaking for myself, but maybe you can relate to this, so much of the time I feel like I know how things ought to go. I know how my life should go, and sometimes I know how other people's lives should go too. And when that doesn't happen in the way that I think it should happen, God, what are you doing? Did you pay attention to my prayer yesterday? When I was going on for 20 minutes to you about this certain thing, how it needed to happen this way, and it didn't. What's going on? Did you take your hands off the wheel? We're not the only generation to struggle like that. I want to go to two Bible passages that are stories in which we see people trying to grapple with this question that God asks in one of these stories: is anything too hard for me? Let's start in Genesis 18, and let's see how our God's work is superior to anything we can possibly imagine. Genesis 18, begin with me here in verse 9. They said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And he said, "She's in the tent." The Lord said, "I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now, Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. The way of women had ceased to be with Sarah. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I am worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure?" The Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old?' Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son." But Sarah denied it, saying, "I did not laugh, for she was afraid." He said, "No, but you did laugh. You did laugh." I want to do two things with this passage. There's a lot to say about Genesis 18. More than we can say right now. I want to do two things with it, though. I want to look at the challenge of the situation, and then I want to look at what the Lord does with it. Okay. So think about the great challenge of this moment that caused Sarah to have the reaction that she has here. Think about how many years it has been since God originally promised to Abraham back in Genesis 12 that he would make a large nation from Abraham. Abraham, we're told back there in Genesis 12, was 75 years old. Eventually, at the time of the great Ishmael experiment, which ended very badly, Abraham was 86 years old. And here, when God finally says, the time has arrived, by the time I come back to your tent next year, you will have that promised son. Abraham is 100 years old, and his wife is 10 years younger than he is, so she's 90. And that's not even counting the married years that Abraham and Sarah had before he was promised at 75 that he would have a son. We don't know how many years that was between when they first got married to when they get that promise there in that passage. And so it's 25 years plus, but it's been 25 years since the promise. And by this time, not only has it been 25 years, they're just really, really old. And verse 11 just flat out says, just in case we were thinking, well, you know, maybe, I mean, older people do have children, it's possible. And verse 11 says, there's no possible way that this naturally could have happened. The way of women had ceased with Sarah. She is not fertile anymore. Okay, well, that's not a possibility then. And so, because of all that, Sarah laughs. But this is always what God likes to do with people. He likes to put people into impossible situations, at least naturally speaking, where it appears that there is no possible way that something can come out of this mess. And the Lord, all throughout the story of Scripture, says, oh, you just watch me work. I mean, and that's from page one. Whenever I sit down with somebody for the very first time and I open the Scriptures with somebody, I always go to Genesis 1, to the first paragraph of the Bible, in which it says, the earth, before day one, before the light, what was the earth like before he starts his creation process? It was formless and void, and darkness was over the face of the waters. It didn't have shape. It didn't have life. It had no light whatsoever. It looked like a big jumble of disaster. But what does God do? What is our first impression of God in Genesis 1? He takes that mess and he creates form. He creates life. He makes order out of the chaos. And that's exactly what he does with Abraham and Sarah in Genesis 18. Now, despite her laughter, we know from reading Hebrews 11 that her momentary doubts about this soon give way to confident faith. Because if you read Hebrews 11, verse 11, it says, by faith Sarah herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age. And so Hebrews picks up on that little detail too. Since she considered him faithful who had promised. God had given enough of a track record for her and her husband to say, yes, despite all evidence to the contrary, I think God's going to do this for us. And of course, you keep reading through the narrative, and he does. They do have Isaac. And by the way, what does Isaac mean in the Hebrew language? Laughter. They named their son Laughter. That always causes me laughter when I think about it. All right, think about what the Lord does with this. What he does is he promises a child. He promises a specific gender for that child. And then, not only that, he promises a time frame that he locks himself into by which this male child will be born from your wife, Sarah, in this kind of way. So that's the first thing. Think about how neat it is that before she is even conceived, God is saying, yes, you're going to be fertile. Yes, you're going to have a child. With everything that has already transpired in their lives, they don't need to go to a fertility doctor. They don't need some voodoo or some witchcraft. They have their God who says, this is going to transpire. This is going to happen. When you go to fertility doctors today, there's going to be a lot of, well, we're going to try this, and we're going to try this, and maybe, and maybe, and maybe. There's none of that tone in this text. You shall have a child. There's no doubt about that. And in fact, he said, did you notice how he says it twice? At the beginning, and then she overhears it, and she laughs, and we deal with the laughter. And then at the very end, as God is wrapping that up, he says it again in verse 14, after he said it already in verse 10. You shall have a son. And notice how the gender of the child is revealed. And that again is brought up here in verse 10 and verse 14. Even with all of the science that has gone into reproduction in the last 100 years or so, there is no way that a doctor can guarantee to me and my wife what child we're going to have when conception occurs. Now, there are ways, and I hate that science has done this, there are ways to create a whole bunch of embryos in a lab so that you can go into your doctor and they can test the embryos and they can test the cells to see, well, this embryo is a male and this embryo is a female. I think I'll pick that one and we can stick the rest in a freezer somewhere where they may or may not be used someday in the future. I hate that science has done that. There are huge moral questions about that process. But I bring all that up to say what is happening here is far more impressive than even what science has been able to do with human reproduction. You will have a son. You will have a child. I can guarantee that, he says. You don't need a gender reveal party because the gender has already been revealed right here before you have even conceived. That's amazing. And again, thirdly, what God does is he says, and I can even tell you when it's going to happen. You're going to have a son by this time next year. Again, verse 10, verse 14, that's brought up twice in the text. You know, if you want to be able to wiggle out of a promise, and maybe some of you have found yourself in those shoes, then what you want to do is you want to promise vague things. Yeah, I will help you this year. That could mean anything, right? And if you remember, at the very beginning in Genesis 12, God was really vague about how Abraham would be made into a great nation. And so Abraham said, well, okay, does that mean that happens to an Egyptian wife? No, it doesn't mean that. Does it happen through my relative Eleazar? No, it doesn't happen through that. I'll tell you exactly how it happens, Abraham. So 25 years later, here it is. It's your wife, and it's a son through her, and it's by this time next year. He locks himself into this because nothing is too difficult for him to accomplish. Okay. So that's number one. Let's go to number two now. Go over to Mark chapter 9, this New Testament passage, entirely different scene, entirely different context, but the same kind of point that we're driving at here, that nothing is too impossible for God. Mark chapter 9, I want to notice with you what is going on, the challenge of the situation, and the Lord's work through it. Chapter 9 of Mark, read with me here in verse 14. When they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and the scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, what are you arguing with them about? And someone from the crowd answered him, Teacher,
I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute, and whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able. And he answered them, O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me. And they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw him, he immediately convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, how long has it been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. And it has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said to him, if you can, all things are possible for the one who believes. Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, I believe, help my unbelief. And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, he's dead. But Jesus took him up by the hand, lifted him, and he arose. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, why could we not cast it out? And he said to them, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. So you think about what is going on in this situation. You have a very long-standing demon possession happening here, as well as unsuccessful disciples who embarrassingly can't do anything about this demon. I want you to think about how many people that Jesus met whenever they were bringing their problems to him. He often encountered people who had had their problems and issues for a very long time. In fact, Bruce even mentioned this Wednesday night in his invitation, which is good, Bruce. Thank you for that. You remember how the man in John chapter 9 is born blind? You don't know how old he is exactly when he meets Jesus, but he's obviously been blind a very long time. In Acts chapter 3, the man who is lame at the beautiful gate that Peter and John meet, he's been lame from birth, and he's over 40 years old by the time he gets healed. So more than four decades have gone by when his disciples encounter him. You recall that in Mark chapter 6, the woman with the flow of blood, who you mentioned Wednesday night, was sick for 12 whole years, more than a decade, before she touches the fringe of Jesus' garment. So this wasn't unusual. I don't know how old this boy was, but it has been a long time since this demon has entered him and been doing these things to him. And not only that, when he takes this boy to, notice how he says it in the text, I tried to take him to you, but you weren't around. So we talked to the next best option, your people, your disciples, and they couldn't do anything with the demon. Now, you know why that is unusual? Now, this is not just a, well, I mean, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Just never know. Depends on the weather. No. When you go back to chapter 3 of Mark, and you look at verses 14 and 15, you see the list of disciples that were called to be apostles. It specifically says in chapter 3, he gave them authority to cast out demons. And then you look at chapter 6, when they've been out running around Israel, it specifically says in chapter 6, verse 12, they had cast out a lot of demons. So this is not their first rodeo. This is their 20th or 30th or 40th rodeo. And here they encounter this demon, and the demon laughs in their face. You think you're going to cast me out? You have a second thing coming. So their failure is pretty shocking here. And so at the end of what we read there, they go to Jesus and they say, "Why? What is going on here? Why couldn't we cast this out? Why were we unsuccessful?" And he basically says to them, it's because you were relying on your own strength to do this and not the Lord's. You weren't praying. This can only be cast out through prayer. You need to do that before you think about exerting power on your own. By the way, is that something we ever struggle with? well, I'm going to march into this situation because I know how to handle people like this. I know the scriptures to fire out. I know the kind of conversation, how it's going to go. I've got this. And then you go in and find out you don't have this at all. Because you weren't praying to God. I'm saying that to me, not just to you.
Well, I think we can all understand that kind of situation and been there before. By the way, something I want to point out about this is this point. Just because we might become disappointed with Jesus' disciples does not mean that Jesus himself does not have the power to cast out the demons that need to be cast out and to do the work that needs to be done. His disciples had a momentary lapse and they were unable to fulfill this job. But that doesn't mean that their Lord can't do this. So many people throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, I was part of a church one time and it didn't go well and I was mistreated and now I'm done with the Lord. You shouldn't be. Just because Jesus' people are not always what they should be, and even sometimes we are too sensitive about that. But even when they're not everything that we should be, that is no reason to abandon the God and the Lord that we serve. Just want to get that point in, because that's important. So by the time Jesus comes, he is kind of at the end of his rope. This man who comes to Jesus is at the end of his rope because of all of these things that happen, and nobody seems to be able to do anything about this. And so he says, if you can. And Jesus latches on to that. But clearly, this man does have some level of faith because he immediately says, Lord, I know that my faith is not where it needs to be, but I do have some level of faith. Please help what I don't have and supplement and add to where I am now. And I think we can find ourselves in the language of this man. How many of us have perfect faith? No, I don't. By this time in Mark's Gospel, Jesus has already healed a man who had a whole legion of demons inside of his body. So from Jesus' perspective, of course, I can help this boy and your family. And so what the Lord does in this situation is he has several reproofs. He wants to reprove the generation of people that he's working with. And he has a little bit of a reproof for the father of this boy. And then finally, he reproves the demon who is inside of this child. In verse 19, look back there. Jesus is showing a little bit of an exasperated tone. If you back up in the context a little bit, Jesus has just been on a mountaintop with a small handful of his disciples, and his clothes have become radiant and white, and Moses and Elijah appeared on either side of him. It was a scene of absolute splendor and glory. Jesus was shown to be, beyond a shadow of a doubt, who he is, the Lord of all lords, the King of glory. But then he goes down the mountain, and nobody understands who he is. And everybody is not showing faith like they should. And everybody's arguing with each other. Scribes are arguing, disciples, this man, squabbles. He's got to break up fights. He's got to say, okay, what is going on? Well, we got this situation. Nobody seems to be able to do anything about it. And so that's when he just says, okay, guys, how long am I going to be here with you guys? And he's not giving up on them. He's not saying, I'm not going to serve you anymore. But he wants to be patient, but sometimes he gets to the point where he's weary. You ever think about that? That our sins, if we show a level of unbelief over a course of time, that has the potential to weary God. He's tired. He's the one, and that's part of why I picked the background for this slide that I did. He's the one who created all of the galaxies in this infinitely, seemingly infinite expanse of universe that we live in. We're told that he has names for all the stars. Do we honestly believe that he is not aware of us and our problems and our needs, and that he is incapable of doing something about them? You and I, and I, again, I'm putting myself here, sometimes we are so silly in what we are concerned about. Anxious and staying up at night wondering, what am I going to do about my future? How am I going to handle X and Y and Z? And how am I going to fit all the puzzle pieces together? You don't have to. That is not your job. And it's not mine either. Thank God. Because we really would all go crazy if that was our task. But it's not. He holds the universe in his hands. Trust him to be God. You got a demon? He knows about it. Your child has a demon. He knows about it. And he can do something about it. Trust him with all of that. So in verse 23, we see Jesus correcting the attitude of the Father. He says, do you realize that all things are possible when I'm in the picture and you believe in me? You ever thought about how many times Jesus says that phrase, all things are possible? In fact, if you just keep reading in Mark's Gospel, you'll find it two more times. If you read in chapter 10, the next chapter, in verse 27, he says it there, right after he has been talking with the rich young ruler, and the rich young ruler goes away really sad, and Jesus looks at his guys and says, let me tell you something. It is so difficult for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's like a camel trying to fit himself through the eye of a needle. And the disciples go, really? Then who can possibly be saved? And that's when Jesus says what he says here. Well, with man, it's not going to happen. But with God, all things are possible. And then you go to Mark 14, and Jesus says that phrase again because he's thinking about what he's about to go through. He's in the garden. He's praying to his Father, and the cross is right there in his timeline. And what he says to his Father is, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. In the last moments of his life, he displays the kind of trust that he is calling upon this man and the other disciples that he has to have in their own lives. Jesus is the perfect one who practices what he preaches. And so, verse 25, he finally addresses the demon itself. This is a really interesting interaction. Did you notice what the demon does after Jesus gives the command? Now, this is a demon who has heard other people tell him to get out. And he's been able, up to this point in time, to laugh in their face. But when Jesus, his creator, because Jesus is the creator of every living thing, whether it's in this realm or the spiritual realm, when his creator gives his voice of command, he cannot resist that. But you notice what he does do. He throws a fit. In fact, he throws such a fit as he's coming out of this boy that in the aftermath of the miracle, the bystanders are looking at this child and they think he's gone. They think he is dead, and oh no, Jesus, that was so powerful that you've actually killed the poor kid. And Jesus said, no, we haven't done that. I haven't done that. He's alive. He takes him up by the hand. Because no amount of demonic power can withstand the force of God, even though this demon withstood everybody else in the crowd. For however many years he was in this child, he can't touch Jesus. Here's the point. It's a simple point from these two stories, but I hope it's one that sinks deeply into your heart and mine, that our God's work
is superior to anything that we can possibly imagine. And that's why I want to end with this passage in Ephesians that John read for us before I got up here. Because Paul, in his prayer to the Ephesian church, basically says that in this prayer. There are several moments in Ephesians where Paul will stop his instruction to them about the kinds of lives he wants them to live in the Lord, and he will pray. And so we have a snapshot of an example of how we are to pray. How do you pray? You address God this way: to him who is able to do far more abundantly than all that we ask or think, according to the power at work within us, to him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. And that's why we're not in charge of planning how our lives are going to run. He can see the big picture. We cannot. And that ought to be so comforting to us here. You know, I don't know everything that's going on in your life. My family has been here long enough, though, that we know a lot of things about most people here. And I know that many of you need to hear this. I know some of you stay awake at night worrying about a lot of things. Please don't do that. Because of this. Because of the God that we serve. We have lots of causes to be concerned. Concerned about the family that we have. Concerned about other people that we love here in the church who might be struggling. Concerned about the state of the nation. Concerned on a macro and a micro level about all kinds of things. Follow what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. Think about the birds. Think about the lilies of the field. Think about all of the little creatures and plants that he takes care of. Because he's able to do far more abundantly than we can handle. And put your trust in him. I'd imagine that there's at least some people here who are struggling to believe this. So I just want to put this in front of you as a reminder to believe that God has this level of power. And that, did you notice the phrase in here? That his power, as great as it is, can be at work within us. He's close by. In fact, if you're walking with him, he's in you. Let him do his work. Enjoy the ride. And trust in him. If you need to devote your life to the Lord now, either for the first time or you need to come back to him, let us know how we can help, how we can pray for you, how we can serve you in any way. As together we stand up, we sing the invitation song.